of that particular situation, again, a case in which a large number of people in the government structure didn't want ABM, and a certain particularly vociferous section of the public also didn't want it. The coalescence of those two movements did in fact stop the anti-ballistic missile from being developed and deployed in this country, and led to the ABM Treaty of SALT I. The fourth case is the case of the last few years, and I mentioned that the other day also. The very unhappy fact that during the Carter years, when there was a real chance of moving something forward, the public, except for the really long time, the people who were in this for the long haul, the public just wasn't interested. The people who swelled the halls when the Physicians for Social Responsibility now has a big colloquium somewhere just weren't there. I don't know where they were, but they weren't in a place like that. They were not supporting President Carter and what he was trying to do. That's as much Carter's fault as anybody else. He just didn't have a talent for organizing that kind of support. But the fact is that those of us who were out there negotiating in those days were acutely aware of the fact there just wasn't any public support back home for what it is we were trying to do. Or at least there wasn't any vocal support. And when I said that the long-term people were continuing their support, even that's a slight overstatement, because some of them were dropping away. I talked with Jeremy Stone about this during the Carter years. You know, where is the FAS even? They were talking about problems of anti-vivisection and things like that. And Jeremy's explanation was that what Carter has done is it hired away most of our people and put them in the government, and they're taking care of all this. And of course, it was widespread. It happened in other areas. Ralph Nader, for example, several of his people were hired and put in the Interior Department or elsewhere. So it was a period during which all sorts of people fell away and decided to let Jimmy do it. And the unhappy fact is that Jimmy wasn't able to do it. Whether a little bit of extra support might have made the difference or not, we'll never know. But I think it might have. Because what finally happened to SALT and also CTB is that they simply got delayed too long and got overtaken by other events. If the process simply could have been speeded up, we would have had at least some success. SALT, maybe not CTB, but certainly SALT. Now we have a new president who turns all of these negotiations off. Everybody gets excited, and so there's tremendous support for negotiations and going ahead, and I would say virtually no prospect of results. So that somehow this matter that the public and the bureaucracy are out of phase in two cases because they were pushing in the same direction at the same time but for different reasons, and now they're pushing in the same direction but at different times, just is something we've got to learn. It's a problem that we've got to fix because there are plenty of people in the government and in the bureaucracy who want to accomplish precisely the same things as the typical person who promotes peace and nuclear negotiations and so on. If we could just get these things together, a great deal more could be accomplished than has been. I just want to mention a little bit about stimuli, having mentioned it in this case of people being stimulated at just the wrong time. I think it is a fairly general problem, especially if one looks at other cases where there is a lot of public activism which produces a lot of results. And the women's movement is one of those. But the big difference is that in the case of the women's movement, half the people in this country are reminded of the problem every time they get a paycheck. But there's never a nuclear war to remind anybody of what the other problem is. And the same thing goes with the environmental movement. You can go out almost anywhere and encounter some smells and some ugly and some ugly appearances and be reminded that there is an environmental problem. But the nuclear problem, somehow, that people don't get reminded of it until something major happens, such as the kind of statements that were made by the American leadership early in this administration. There are other things one has to note when you talk about the public and public support and public interest, and that is that I can't help but note that in the four presidential elections where it's obvious that the peace issue was important, it went the other way. The cases are 1952, when Eisenhower beat Stevenson because people were quite dissatisfied with the way the Democrats had handled the Vietnam War and the whole military balance question in general. In 1960, when Kennedy beat Nixon, because Nixon was tarred with what Kennedy was able to persuade the public about the inadequate approach that the Eisenhower administration had taken with respect to space and missiles. In 72, when Nixon beat McGovern, and in 1980, when Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter. Now, since 1980, in 1982, there was the vote on the freeze, in which people all over the country, I guess it adds up to a clear majority if you work the figures right, voted for the freeze. Does that mean people are shifting in that way or not? I'm not sure. I hope it does, but it's easy to explain it quite differently. And that is to say that when people look at single issues, they can vote a single issue, and it's always been true it's been true for a long time that the average American has felt that nuclear war was a dumb idea, as I said the other day. On the other hand, when an election comes, you have to choose a candidate. There's a whole panoply of things, and even limiting oneself just to the question of military preparedness and so on. When the public is faced with the choice of voting for standing tall in the saddle and facing up to those people, they'll pick that over the question of reducing nuclear arms. Well, some cases in which I've mentioned some of the cases in which groups have entered into the fray and have made some difference, including all the way back at the beginning, Federation of American Scientists, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The Federation, and it's interesting to note the ways in which these organizations go about their job. I think some of them are more effective than others, and I will just mention a few cases in which I think that they're especially effective, in which the techniques they use are especially effective. The Federation, since I mentioned them first, lobbies, but it really does its lobbying in the most efficient possible way. It lobbies the Senate. There are 100 senators. The senators deal with foreign relations. It doesn't lobby the House. There's more than 400 members of the House, and they don't play the same role with respect to things like foreign relations. And they lobby the Senate by working in a very close and friendly and frequent fashion, not just with the senators themselves, in fact, not so much with the senators themselves, as with the Senate staffers. It's a relatively small organization. The number of people who are dues-paying members of the Federation runs around 20,000 only, but it has been very effective in a substantial number of instances of adopting a point of view and then selling that particular point of view, persuading the people that it dealt with, the Senate staffers, to that particular point of view. Another interesting case is the Council for a Livable World, which was founded around 1960 by Leo Szilard. They focus on what I mentioned earlier was what I regard as the primary pressure point for all of this sort of thing, and that is the elections. They have, from the beginning, sought out elections in which there was a chance that the election could go either way. I mean, that is to say, they sought out close elections and elections in which it mattered which way it went. And that's a fairly small number of elections, but then they took all of their resources and focused precisely on those. And there again, there are quite a number of over the years quite a number of senators who were there quite possibly, even probably, because of the particular actions of this particular group. And when one is dealing with just 100 people, 100 voting members of a major deliberative body, shifting it by just a couple people can make a very big difference. But they played major roles on both sides, both political parties. They were instrumental in electing Republicans like Mathias, Case, Cooper, and Brooke, and then a great many Democrats, McGovern, Church, and so on. So so that the Council for a Livable World is another relatively small group of activists who've been in there with a lot of stamina over a lot of years now and who have really made a difference. I mentioned the bulletin. The Union of Concerned Scientists is another important one. It's younger than some of these others. I mentioned earlier the recent work that it's been doing with regard to preparing really high quality position papers. I think that can be I think that can make an important contribution. There are other kinds of groups. Some of them even smaller. There's the Pugwash movement and things like that, which. But I won't mention those. Let me just move quickly on to the question of universities, and then throw the meeting open for the discussion and questions. I think this is the kind of problem in which universities are particularly well suited for making a contribution. That, of course, depends critically on what I earlier said was my view of the problem. That is to say, it's a long-term problem. It's not a short-term problem. It's going to be a long time in developing the kind of world that will where this problem will really be solved. And in the meantime, there's going to be the continuous problem of maintaining the peace and avoiding nuclear war. So it's a long-term problem. It's not something, no matter how dangerous you may think it is, it's not something that has to be solved tomorrow. It would be good if it was. And probably it ought to be solved tomorrow, but it's not likely to be. It is going to be here for a long time. There's plenty of time for long-term efforts to play a role. There's a need for long-term efforts. So it's a long-term problem, it's a difficult problem that has a lot of dimensions to it. Precisely the kind of thing that a community of scholars, in all the different ways that a community of scholars works, can contribute to. Many of them are ways in which you may not feel much is happening very quickly, but nevertheless the collective result of all of these things can really amount to something. One point is, well, I could even turn around. I mean, once when I was in, all the circumstances are unimportant. I was in the State Department when one of the people who was there suddenly said to me, "We do too read your papers." I mean, he wasn't talking to me, but I mean you, meaning the academic community generally. The fact is that there are thousands of people throughout the national security military bureaucracy, in the services, in the war colleges, in the Pentagon, in the State Department, in the Foreign Service, in the White House, among the advisors, thousands upon thousands of persons who do read books and who do read the materials that are published by scholars and universities when it's worth reading. Now, they don't read polemics. I mean, they're not easily swayed by slogans. They're not interested in a person who suddenly discovers that nuclear weapons ought to be eliminated and writes them a letter that says, "I have discovered that nuclear weapons are bad and should be eliminated." But they do read books, and they do take in those arguments, and they do talk about it. Scholarly work in this field, publications, books, articles, and so on, do have their cumulative impact, do affect what's happening. The fact is that we collectively, I mean the government, the bureaucracy, the people, the intellectuals, and so on, do in fact learn. There is a memory in the bureaucracy that's there and that is effective. There are some terrible cases. There are some catastrophes in which whole chunks of memory have been eliminated, like the removal of all the old China hands in the 40s and the purge of ACDA that took place in 1972. But generally speaking, the bureaucracy goes on, the bureaucracy does learn, the bureaucracy does remember, and it is my view, and I can't prove it very well, that the approach to these problems, whether it's quite right yet or not, it's a different story, but the approach to these problems now is more sophisticated than it was 20 years ago, and that's a good thing. And I think that as time goes on, it will become more so. The bureaucracy, the government does in fact learn and remember, and things do eventually happen. There is, of course, a flow of people back and forth. I've mentioned people here already. Frank Long's another one, who have been in the government, in the university, sometimes in the government a second time. They participate in the learning process here, in talking with, in learning what's going on, forming their views and so on, and have the opportunity to actually get into the government and do something about them from time to time. And the reverse process takes place. There are people from the government who come here as short-term lecturers, long-term scholars, and who can contribute to your understanding of what the problems are as seen from that particular very important perspective. And of course, most important, lastly, is the question of students. There are all kinds of courses in which there are opportunities for young people to learn something more about the problem and about its roots and about those factors that have to be understood if anything's going to be done about it. There are courses specifically devoted to that end, like the Peace Studies seminar that I attended here just a few days ago with Ned Lebeau and Judith Reppe, but there are courses all over the country that have words like peace and arms race and so on in their titles. But equally important are courses that are classical courses in the modern American history, courses in East-West relations, courses in East Europe, where people do a job already of trying to explain the roots and get a better understanding of these problems, and where a lot more can be done. In my university, the University of California, we are trying to expand this kind of activity. We're having summer seminars for faculty so that people from any department in which a course is taught that bears on this subject can come and learn more about it, learn about elements of it that he or she wouldn't ordinarily be touching. And one result is we're getting courses from areas you'd never expect. It's plausible to get them in history and political science and so on, but we're getting them in all kinds of departments, religion, medicine, and so forth. We have one professor of Russian who regularly gave a course in Tolstoy. He has expanded that slightly so that he covers nonviolence in general. He has a good course built on his previous Tolstoy course that covers nonviolence in general. And there are all kinds of other things like that. So there is a lot universities can do. Universities are already doing more than many people in them seem to know. It's always possible to do more, and I hope, in fact, that we all will. But let me end this last session on that particular more upbeat note than the last one, and turn the floor over and open the floor for questions. Yes?
Mr. Yoa, you have mentioned a number of groups just in the last part of your speech, the people, the government, the bureaucracy, the universities, and so on and so on. But if I don't believe I heard you mention business and industry, and I wonder if you would like to comment on your beliefs about whether or not business and industry, specifically the military industrial complex, is as interesting as it ought to be in eliminating this problem of nuclear arms race.
Well, business, of course, that was an omission. I guess it's probably obvious why. It usually weighs in a somewhat different way. The industry does involve itself. I mean, the defense industry is much involved in all of this, has been for years and years. I would say that the defense industry, by and large, is just as interested in preventing and avoiding nuclear war as anyone else, but they do tend to take a somewhat different perspective with respect to exactly how to accomplish that. So do the people who work in the defense industry. I mean, there's lobbying by the unions as much as there is by the management and by other kinds of employees. But they too are interested in avoiding nuclear war. They do have a different perspective. There are, of course, certain small business groups in which they specifically address the problem in much the same way that, say, most of the typical peace groups would. Just as an instance, and I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but just as an instance, the leadership in the Freeze campaign in California was taken by Harold Willens, who is a businessman and heads an organization of businessmen for nuclear security or something. I forgot exactly the name. And then, of course, there are other groups I didn't mention. There are churches and so forth. The But I mentioned the bishop's letter the other day, and I think that will play an extremely important role. I mentioned the fact that in the case of the Diocese of Oakland and the Livermore Laboratory, there was actually a colloquium had been set up to try and discuss this problem further. So there are other groups I left out. Yeah. Jane?
Yeah.
Well, it is a problem. It does cut the benefits back, but I have no doubt whatsoever that the net benefit of going ahead with salt. And so I think that's a grave mistake that some people backed away for that particular reason. Well, I'm not sure what to say. It is a fact of life that there is a bargaining process, and that Washington is a political city, and it does involve trading back and forth. And part of the trade for getting support for an arms control measure is usually something else that sometimes tends to counterbalance and sometimes does not. I think probably things like that happen everywhere. I think that any place where there's more than one person with absolute authority, I think a similar process happens. Yeah. Right.
Well, let me make an addition. I think it's clear that with many people, the understanding of the nuclear problem and the peace and war problem is fairly thin. It's a complex thing. It involves not merely technology, but political relations. And the consequence is that a lot of the public, there's a kind of a weather vane effect, that they will be supporting in one period, and the Gallup poll will show people strongly in favor of peace and arms reductions, and then something not really fundamental like the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan can occur, and suddenly the opinion polls reverse. And I think that the lesson to we in the universities, to us in the universities, is that this education problem is a serious one. It's only if you give people understanding these things in some depth that you can hope to maintain a balanced view and really understand what are the most important things and the ones that they really must focus on, so that the educational process is surely a key one. You want to argue that?
No, that's not. Hans, yeah.
How do you think the policy is arrived at in Russia?
Well, I, yeah.
Increase, decrease, etc.
I don't know how it's arrived at. I think I do have some feeling for some of the features, and that is that there clearly are interest groups, and the officer corps is one of them. I think we now, enough time's gone by, enough information is available that we see the special problem that made for Khrushchev, and the way it added to other things he did, which were unpopular, with the agriculture, with the Cuba, and so forth. The way that played a role in his being the only general secretary of the Communist Party that's been unseated. The other thing we see, I think, that we've gradually developed some understanding of, that is similar to that, is the role of the institutes. That is to say, the technological institutes, the aircraft institutes, the missile institutes, and those other large units, in promoting their own continuity. Because because the outstanding characteristic of the Russian development program when compared to the American program is the steadiness of the Russian program. It just goes on and on and on, not with no evidence of being influenced by outside events, turning out new missiles with a periodicity that seems to be coupled to five-year plans. And then what little one knows from people who've been there and are in a position to talk about it, that it's quite evident that they conduct a selling process. That is, as they go up through higher levels, that persuades the higher levels of the need for their particular activity and product. So there is this thing which they call the military-industrial committee, I think, in which all those things feed, which plays a major role in determining procurement policy, and that in turn sets other things. But I certainly don't have a very complete understanding of the answer to your question. How are decisions made? It's clear they're collective, and it's clear that they are. However much authority one individual may have as chairman of the Politburo, that nevertheless there are interest groups, and those interest groups are able to weigh in and achieve compromises and promote their causes in the same way that interest groups in any other complex society do. Louder. Can I take, all right. Let me take the second one first, and then you can remind me of the first one. The second one was if small nuclear weapons make nuclear war more likely than large ones because they're easy to use, then don't conventional weapons make it still easier? I think you have put your finger on a problem there, and there is a position, and I think in fact among what you might call defense intellectuals it's even a majority position that hinges on that. That is to say, let me oversimplify by saying there are three possible positions with respect to using nuclear weapons to fight a war in Europe, or rather there are at least three common positions. One of them is that you can't possibly use nuclear weapons to fight in Europe, and you should say so in advance. That's the no first use group. Another group is that you can too use them, and you ought to be prepared to do so. That is, you can use them usefully to fight a war, you ought to be prepared to do so. Those two groups both are minorities. There is a group in the middle, which probably is an absolute majority, which says, of course you can't use nuclear weapons to fight a war in Europe. But for heaven's sakes, don't make that policy. We need that extra ambiguity in order to preserve the peace. That is in effect the position of the group of Germans who replied to, it was a German gang of four, wasn't it, who replied to the American gang of four. The American gang of four was McNamara, Bundy, Kennan, and Smith, who proposed no first use, and who belong to one of those three groups I mentioned. That is the group that says you can't use them to fight a war and you ought to say so. The reply from these Germans, which, as I say, I think represent a majority among defense intellectuals, was consistent with this middle policy, which says, of course, you can't effectively use them to fight a nuclear war, but you need them to deter a general war. And a somewhat more sophisticated addition to that is that if you made conventional war more likely by any act, and that could include an act of removing some of the danger by eliminating nuclear weapons, if you make the probability of conventional war greater, then surely if a conventional war happens, it'll go nuclear anyway, and so you're really worse off. So there are arguments that kind of build and lead in various directions, and all I can say is they all involve the future, and I simply can't, you know, I don't know what the future holds. I've resolved those questions myself on a fairly simple basis of saying that nuclear war is easily distinguishable from conventional war in its degree of death and destruction, and that eliminating the probability of nuclear war even to first order is a good thing, and I don't know about the second order terms. I would take my risks by following the easier path towards reducing the probability of nuclear war, but there is an argument on the other side. Now, what was your first question?
My first question was just
whether there's a
the difference between all first use weapons and battlefield weapons.
Well, sure, but battlefield weapons are weapons like artillery, whose purpose is to stop a massed armor attack, and so that unless they're used as soon as the armor attack begins, and whether or not nuclear weapons are used on the other side, they can't stop the armor attack. They'll be over. I mean, if that's the way you're planning on stopping the armor, you have to use them. You have to use them or lose them. So that they are weapons which are most effective if used first. You know, they're not weapons that could only be used first. I mean, they don't have a switch that fixes it so you can only use them first, but they are weapons which are much more effectively used if you're prepared to use them first.
Maybe we could add, maybe you could give up after we're talking. Can we have just one more question? Kurt?
Well, I wanted to hear you
loudly.
You said that the government has long-term memory, but it's my impression, I'd like you to hear your comment. In fact, it was at a conference that Frank organized for a congressional staffer who was, I think, probably 30 years old, came in and told us that Congress has no memory. I am an old congressional staffer who looked 30 years old. He said, within Congress, most of the staff is in the early mid-20s or so. Congressmen are hardly in office, usually more for than a few terms. And now when you have, say, some issue like the ballistic missile defense issue coming up, there are very, very few members of Congress or their staff who know the arguments that were made 20 years ago. And if that's true, then there really is another educational effort that's needed, which is to maintain congressional knowledge.
Well, that's right. There is a very high turnover. There's turnover at every level, but there also are people who are there for a long time, and I admit I can't bring to mind any gray-haired staffers, but there are congressmen who've been there quite a long time, and there are even people who rotate. I mean, there are people who are in for a while, out, and then back 20 years later. So that there, in addition to people who are there all the time, there are even those who go back. Sally Zuckerman has written at length on the fact that in America that does happen. I mean, that there is this interchange between academia and government, and that it involves repetition. And he says that's a good thing we don't have over here in England or in Europe.
Well, it is not given the talk that we bring this to a halt. I clearly am speaking urban. For all of the group, and I tell you how very much we've appreciated the talks and how grateful we are. You talked about an exceedingly timely and important subject. You were clear and lucid, and you told us a lot of things that will help us to be a little bit more activist and more vigorous. And for all of these things, we're really grateful. Thank you very much.